Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé, Silent Night, Dream Scenario, Good Burger 2, and Doctor Who the Star Beast. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring MST3K Season 13. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's look at the box office first and see what happened last weekend. It was an interesting box office because The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, kind of came up from behind. It was the previous week's winner, and over Thanksgiving weekend, it ended up winning not just the three-day, but the five-day weekend. That's actually pretty good for that franchise, even though it opened lower than the other Hunger Games movies. The staying power was pretty decent from weekend to weekend. It only dropped about 35%. Napoleon came in second, and it overperformed. It was a little bit more. I mean, it's not nearly the money that they needed. I mean, it made like $20 million over the three-day weekend and 30-some million dollars over the five-day. That's not nearly enough to cover its like $200 million budget, but it's better than they thought. And you know, I guess that shows there is room for grown-up stories about history, and these sort of epics tend to do well now and then. You can never tell which one's gonna click at the box office. The big news, though, was Wish, which was supposed to top the weekend, came in third, only making $32 million on the five-day weekend and $19 million or $20 million on the three-day. Now, that's way lower than anyone expected. They were predicting upwards of $50 million, maybe $45 to $50 million. So, unfortunately for Disney, that's another disappointment. I'm not going to say flop. People like to throw the word flop around. And I always am cautious about that because, like, a movie like Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, they say, it's a flop, it's a bomb. And I'm like, can you really call a movie that made $500 million a bomb? It's disappointing, and it didn't make back the money they spent on it. But $500 million is a lot of tickets to be sold. It's not the number they wanted. Flops are movies they spend $100 or $200 million on, and they don't make back even like 10 or 20. That's a flop in my estimation. When it comes to Wish and a lot of these Disney movies, they just underperformed. And I've said before, I've had a huge record of saying, maybe you should just stop making movies that cost $200 million plus. You know, maybe go back to the Blumhouse model where, you know, like Thanksgiving, it came in fifth. Trolls Band Together came in fourth, but Thanksgiving came in fifth. And everyone's like, oh, what? That's a box office juggernaut. That's done very well. I mean, the total amount that Thanksgiving's made, it was less than what Wish made in the three-day weekend. But the fact that they spent about $8 on Thanksgiving, that's what makes it a hit. That's what makes horror movies do well, is when they have these budgets that are less than $20 million, and then, you know, even if they just make 30 or 40 worldwide, they're considered profitable. Now, along that line, Bob Iger was interviewed this week, and I believe it was published in Variety, but there was this whole article that talked about him explaining what his theory is as to why something like The Marvels flopped. And I'm going to say that flopped because it underperformed even for Marvel, so that's a kind of a bust. And what's so funny about it is I read the article and I'm like, yeah, he has no idea. Because you know what his reasoning was? Basically, his explanation for why The Marvels didn't do well was he was less involved, or the executives and the studio bosses were less involved because it was shot during COVID, and so there was less day-to-day studio bosses, executives on the set. And that's absolute bullpucky. I mean, it's a weird way of taking ownership of it by saying, it's our fault because we weren't involved enough. They didn't have enough oversight. There are so many reasons why The Marvels was a disappointment, because it was drawing from characters on a TV series that people aren't necessarily watching, and even though they were popular on Disney Plus, they weren't reaching the vast audience that they got, and they weren't the well-known characters, and you're in the lull already. You had already had several slower Marvel movies, and it was continuing a trend. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons why The Marvels did not do as well as they wanted to, and zero of them are about more executive oversight, more meddling by the studio. Yes, because that usually makes it work. A meddling by the studio makes it better. I mean, I get it. Bob Iger's got to save his job. He's doing absolute damage control. He just doesn't want to be the guy who was the last one holding the ball when the Disney movies collapsed. And that's okay. This happens before. If you recall, back in 2012, they were ready to collapse before then because they had had a string of disappointments. And it wasn't until they had their hands on the Avengers when they first got the Marvel franchise, that's when they kind of suddenly became this juggernaut again. This is a general cycle for movies and studios. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I'm going to cover a couple new things that are going to be coming out in the new year. The first one is the first release that we're going to get in 2024, and that is Night Swim, which comes to theaters on January 5th.
When we were fixing up the pool,
stop!
They said it hadn't been used in 15 years. Maybe they weren't pool people. I used to be scared of pools.
Hey, someone's coming over in a minute.
Marco,
you need to say something back. Ronan, Marco.
Why aren't you saying anything?
My kids have seen things, and I'm worried something is happening to my husband.
Honestly, this looks interesting. I mean, this is a very typical Blumhouse movie. This is a very typical early January film. It's a horror film. I haven't looked it up. I don't know whether it's PG-13 or R. I'm not one of those people that it has to be R. I know there are people out there who refuse to see a horror movie if it's PG-13. I'm just like, well, fine. I don't, as long as it's scary. You can have a terrifying movie that actually doesn't have any violent content to it. You don't have to have decapitations and blood and guts everywhere. It just has to be sort of scary. And, you know, swimming in a pool at night can be scary. Swimming in the ocean is terrifying at night because it is just nothing but blackness and darkness below you. But this plays off the swimming pool idea, and I think that's good. One thing I think is interesting is you got Carrie Condon in this. And she's an Irish actor. Her last film that I remember her in was The Banshees of Inisherin. And she was brilliant in that. And she got a bunch of award nominations and a recognition. And here she is now doing a crappy horror movie, which is probably going to be seen more than people saw The Banshees of Inisherin anyways. But so that's good for her. I like Carrie Condon. I'd like to see her get a little bit more work in the American cinema. The next trailer I want to play is for Ted, which is coming to Peacock on January 11th.
You should be going to school every day with John.
No, thanks.
You might have fun.
No, I would not have fun. I guard the house when you guys are out.
What happened to the TV?
It was an accident.
You're going to school and you're going to grow a brain.
Oh, come on.
If I get drunk, well, I know I'm going
to
be.
Hey, Dork, you bringing your dolls to school?
It's the 90s. Times are changing.
I haven't smoked. I haven't had sex. I haven't had a girlfriend. I'm a loser.
Can we have drugs, please? Let's do this right.
Yep, they're doing a Ted series based on the Ted movies by Seth MacFarlane, and it's the story of Johnny, I think, is the character who's in the movies played by Mark Wahlberg, but it's him as a teenager growing up and his relationship with Ted. I don't know, this might be fine. I mean, certainly Seth MacFarlane knows how to put together a situation comedy. I mean, he does it in animation all the time. I just don't know the longevity of the Ted stories. I thought it burned out its weed jokes by the second film, and I'm just wondering if it's just going to be more of the same for the TV series. But, you know, hey, they're not going to have censors. They can put whatever swear words or crass comments they want on there, so I guess that works for Seth MacFarlane's content. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé, and Good Burger 2. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews, and we're going to start with a movie that I actually haven't seen. I'll be honest with you, I've not seen it. And that's okay, because I'm really not the main target market for a film like this, mainly because it's a concert film. I'm not really into concert films. It doesn't matter what band they are. I'm not a big concert guy anyways, partly because of the expense, but I'm way too old. I don't have the energy to go to a concert and wait in line and stand there and dance and have all these other people freaking out around me. And I hate when people use cell phones in movies. It'd be worse than a concert because everybody's going to have a cell phone out. Nothing against Beyonce. Mad respect for Beyonce. And I mean, the same thing with Taylor Swift. I talked a lot about Taylor Swift because you couldn't escape her from the news this year, but she had that concert film, and so I had, at least addressed it. Although what's funny is, the last time there was a sort of like a Taylor Swift Beyonce feud, not a feud, but sort of going head to head, because here they're going against their concert films. Because here's the thing, if Beyonce's concert film does not do at least close to what Taylor Swift's did, there's going to be some people that are upset about it. But the last time Taylor Swift beat out Beyonce, there was this big hubbub, because that's when Kanye West grabbed the mic away from her. During her speech. Could you imagine if Kanye West did that now? For two reasons, not just because Kanye West is persona non grata and a complete psychopath out there talking about how great Hitler is and having sex in public places in, like, what was it, in Venice or something when he did that? But the Taylor Swifties, the fans of Taylor Swift would not tolerate that. They would just, they would descend upon Kanye and they'd walk away and there'd just be bones. It'd be like locusts on top of him. Anyways, music superstar Beyonce brings her latest concert experience to cinemas.
So, do you like the show?
I don't know what you're waiting for. Cuff it.
Today ain't the day.
Okay.
Cause I'm in the mood to be deep in love.
We just need to simplify.
Time is my biggest obstacle. It's impossible to not realize how fast it's going when you are looking through the eyes of your children.
A lot of these concert films are not just wall-to-wall music. They also serve a bit as a documentary, especially if you look at the ones that they started putting out in the theaters, like with the Jonas Brothers and Miley Cyrus, and even This Is It, the Michael Jackson concert documentary film. And this goes all the way back to essentially what Spinal Tap was making fun of all the way back in the 80s. This is a behind the scenes of how she does her work and how she does her music. It also reminds me a little bit of that Truth or Dare movie that Madonna did back in the early 90s, which is actually a really good movie. It's a great look behind what goes on to put together a show like that. Everyone, has the misconception that everyone's just partying, going crazy during a concert tour. But I mean, if it's a busy concert tour, you got to keep your energy up. No wonder so many of these stars get, quote, exhaustion and have to leave or change the tour. Anyways, it's for the fans, like any of these movies are. I mean, I'm not even going to give a rating for it because they didn't screen it, but I wasn't expecting him to. I'm not upset that they didn't screen it. It's not like Napoleon where I'm like, come on, Sony, can you show me the movie, for crying out loud? Because I don't have 17 hours to go see that movie in the theaters. But that's it. Renaissance, a film by Beyonce. That's out in theaters this week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Good Burger 2. This actually dropped on Paramount Plus last week, and I was very curious about it. I'd never seen Good Burger. I never really followed the Kenan and Kel phenomenon. That was a very early 90s or mid-90s thing. So I was in college at the time. I was a bit too old to be watching Nickelodeon at the time. But I was curious about this. I've actually saved Good Burger on my queue. I haven't watched the first one yet. I mean, I figured this isn't like Chinatown and the Two Jakes. These aren't heavily tied together movies. I figured I could catch up and watch Good Burger 2 and know what's going on. A massive corporation wants to buy the Good Burger restaurant and reinvent it as a global robotic franchise.
Buckle up! The new adventures of Ed and Dex starts now! You think I can get a job at Good Burger?
I'm putting a good word to Mr. Jess. That's not soap, by the way. It's maple syrup.
Why?
Are you using a plunger to unclog the shake machine, as in the same plunger we use to unclog the toilet?
No. Welcome to Good Burger. Can I take your order?
Whoa. Megacorp wants to replace everybody with robots. We gotta do something.
So essentially, the people who were in the Good Burger come back, and one of them, played by Kel Mitchell, he has always been there, and it's sort of like that's his thing, but he's the dim-witted one, but somehow manages to run a restaurant and unclog the shake machine with a toilet plunger. I don't understand why he's not shut down yet, but anyways, it's and people still go. You do not want to know what goes on behind the counters at some of the fast food restaurants you go to. But you know, here's the thing. I thought this was kind of a fun movie. I went in knowing nothing. Like I said, the best I knew about Kenan Thompson was that he was on Saturday Night Live, and I saw some of his sketches. But otherwise, I don't have the background, but, you know, I caught up, and it looks, it's funny, it's absurd, and it's silly, and it's over the top. But I will say, the humor, there's this really strong mix of absurdist children's-like humor, stuff that you would see almost on a cartoon level, mixed with some real biting adult satire. I mean, like, the whole story is about this mega corporation wanting to buy the restaurant and then franchise it out. But the way they want to do it is they want to create robotics and animatronics to do it and get rid of all the people who work there. You know, this was made before the actor's strike took place and the writer's strike took place, but it still has this undercurrent of not wanting AI to take over. It's this weird microcosm of the fears of AI. And I mean, not to say, look, McDonald's has touchscreen, you can order, and a lot of places have apps that you really don't need people at the cash register taking your orders, or at least not at the level that you used to. And that's just sort of like the direction of business. But you will always see that fear of it. And this goes back 100 years during the age of automation, you know, after the Industrial Revolution, when you suddenly started, especially in the mid-20th century, started to have machines that could do the work of men. You no longer needed all the people on the assembly line. You could replace them with robotic functions. And the reality is you can't go either way, because everything done by human hands sometimes isn't going to be cost efficient. But everything done by computers, you may not have the quality control. If you have everything by robotics, we've all gotten some food that was packaged poorly because it was just on the assembly line, and that's just where something happened. We've gotten food or product or something was sealed wrong. So you get weird stuff happening if it's 100% automated, but there's always been, the human nature's always had a fear of automation. And I found that this strange little undercurrent of this movie, all wrapped up in this goofy sort of, like I said, it's like a cartoon, really, but it's funny. I mean, it's basal. I mean, it's children's humor. As I said, it's a cartoon. It's a Nickelodeon cartoon. It's live action. But I mean, it's silly and absurd, but this family comedy has some genuinely heartfelt and hilarious moments. I laughed a lot. I found myself laughing out loud a couple times, so I was surprised. I go, that was actually pretty clever. Plus, you've got people like Jillian Bell is hilarious in the movie. Lil Rel Howard is also really funny in the movie. So you got some nice stars to populate it. So I kind of enjoyed it. I'm going to go have to watch Good Burger, the beginning, later. But for now, I'm going to say that Good Burger 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Silent Night and Dream Scenario.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas just like...
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews and talk about Silent Night. When a man's son is killed during a gangland shooting on Christmas Eve, he embarks on an unrelenting mission of revenge.
Shots fired. All units, please respond.
noticed the trailer had very little dialogue. There was a couple bits in the beginning where it had like a police scanner saying, you know, shots fired, you know, all units report type thing. But that's the gimmick of the movie. It's not me just being lazy and slapping on some music. That's literally what the movie is. That's the catch of it. And that's cool. I mean, I don't mind a gimmick in a movie. And I don't know if it's really a gimmick because it's less of a selling point. I didn't know this until I actually looked it up. And I'm like, oh, this doesn't have any dialogue. So it's not like it was being sold that way. It reminds me a little bit of that movie, the one that was Caitlin Dever and there was an alien invasion. It started out as a home invasion thing, but it was an alien invasion. It was on Hulu just a couple weeks ago. And that one was one that didn't have any dialogue as well. And I think that those are interesting. Those to me are they're gimmicky though. They're sort of like the one-shot films. You know, I even remember when I was a kid, I got a Batman comic and it was sometime in the late 80s, maybe early 90s, and a Batman comic and it was done with no dialogue. There was one line of dialogue where at the end Commissioner Gordon says something like "Good Lord" or whatever it is, it's or one word or something like that, and that's it. All the rest is done just with the art. And there's challenges to storytelling something like that. And giving it to John Woo seemed like a good idea for that because John Woo is known as an action director. I mean, he cut his teeth doing action movies in Hong Kong. He's a big name. And then he started doing American movies right in the 90s. He did like Hard Target and Face Off and Broken Arrow. And he did Mission Impossible 2. Paycheck. He did a whole bunch and then he kind of stopped doing the studio stuff for Hollywood and went back to Hong Kong. So he hasn't done an American Hollywood movie in like 20 years. So this is his return. And when you look at this, you're seriously realizing, yeah, he's more grounded and gritty in this one than he was doing stuff like I said, Paycheck or Broken Arrow. Those are kind of really over the top, big budget Hollywood films. One of the things with John Woo is he has certain signature moves. Now, at least this thing wasn't just filled with white doves, because him with white doves is a big John Woo thing, and it kind of became absurd in the late 90s, early 2000s when he was still making his movies. Everything had white doves in it. You could be on a different planet and white doves would show up. So he doesn't do that, but he has other elements, visual elements that are very John Woo-ish, and they break with the pacing of the movie because he gets to these points that he kind of lets the scene breathe a bit, and it breathes a little bit too much. The other thing is, like, my biggest complaint with the movie is Joel Kinnaman plays the main character, and he's good. I mean, he does a good job. But in this movie's an hour and 40-some minutes long, and it really feels like it could have been about a half hour. Because it starts off with a lickety-split high-octane scene where he's going after the bad guys on the day it happens. And then we follow it through with him in the grieving process and him in the recovery because he's injured himself. And that lasts for an hour. And that just it just goes on very, very long. And it's those moments that the lack of dialogue or not having dialogue take something away. You feel like it's not fully exploring it. So I wish they would have gone faster through that because it goes on forever and it drags. The other thing is then by the time you get to the end, you want to just see this just lickety split, explosive, nonstop action, you know, the kind of attacks that like Liam Neeson was doing 10 or 15 years ago in the movies, not the stuff that he's been doing in the last 4 or 5 years. And you kind of get that. But because John Woo is not making the flashy action movies anymore, some of these scenes, they're underlit, they're hard to look at. I mean, and even as good as the action can be at times, it just falls flat because it's not lit well because everybody's going to that naturalistic lighting. And then there's moments where I really didn't understand what the people were trying to accomplish. Like there's a whole scene where when he finally does his assault, I'm like, how did it get to this point? It just seemed things were happening that I didn't know was happening. And he just kind of stumbles upon things. And I'm not exactly sure what the character's motivations are through everything. And then it would come screeching to a halt with what are meant to be touching moments of memory. So I don't know. It's a nice gimmick with no dialogue, but director John Woo has trouble sustaining the story and keeping the action consistent. Unfortunately, I was looking forward to this one, but I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Dream Scenario. Nicolas Cage plays a mild-mannered professor who suddenly starts appearing in people's dreams.
Paul, you've been on my mind recently.
Huh?
Because you keep popping up in my dreams. You don't do anything, you're just there.
So, this specific person, the remarkable nobody, I've also had that experience.
Do you have a picture?
There's like 100 messages. Somebody wants to interview me.
Well, this is strange. Maybe you should take a minute and think before you do anything drastic.
I really feel like you're playing with fire.
I'm not actually doing anything to them.
One of the things I love about Nicolas Cage's career now, because he's had his ups and downs, you know, he did stuff like Face Off, you know, with John Woo. But then he fell down on his luck, and he was then taking any movie he could so he could pay off some debts. And now he's being a little more decisive about what movies he takes. And so he picks some very interesting stuff. And Dream Scenario is very interesting because it's not typical Cage. It has him doing big things, but he's not going full Cage in all of this stuff. He's not just turning into a caricature of a screaming, yelling Ghost Rider type character that he normally does. This one, he plays it within the constraints of this sort of doughy, middle-aged, frumpy professor. And it's a great idea, and it has some really interesting things to say. It unearths some incredible ideas. It doesn't fully explore those, though, because it's really not about the situation. It's more about the character. It's a study of this guy who becomes inadvertently famous, and he becomes famous in a way that's unlike you would expect. Like, he's not a rock star or an actor in the movie. He's just a dumpy little professor. It's an allegory, I think, for people becoming internet famous, people becoming memes, people going viral and not meaning to. Like that woman who's like on the plane going, that person's not real. That person's not real. You know, somebody like that is not a public figure, and they're not making money off of something like that. She may be trying to capitalize on that, but the initial fame of somebody in going viral, it's just fame. And fame is a double-edged sword, and people do like to watch the downfall. And so when it starts off as it's just a very benign appearance in people's dreams, and it's just this kind of this phenomenon. But then he starts doing things in the dreams, and people start dreaming him doing some pretty awful things, and then they blame him. It plays around with stuff like privacy. Like, you know, do you have the right to go into somebody's head? If you could. And where do you draw the line? Do they have a right to invade you? And then also about perspective, because if you're the one dreaming something horrible, it's not his fault. It's sort of like the joke of the husband and wife sleeping together and the wife waking up and punching the husband in the arm because she dreamed he was having an affair. And it's like, I had nothing to do with it. He's like, just because you dreamed it doesn't mean I did it. It stumbles into that idea, and I really found that interesting, but it doesn't fully explore it. It's more about this guy just making bad decision after bad decision. And that's the reality because, you know, people, when they become internet famous, when they go viral, they are usually faced with a string of terrible decisions, and they could have handled things so much better, but they don't because that's not what they're used to doing. They're just a professor who does not have any sort of fame or notoriety. I really enjoyed that aspect to it. But I mean, what I wanted it to be is not what the movie is trying to be. And I don't fault the movie for that. I just kind of wanted to see something a little bit more. But I mean, still, you know, while it doesn't fully explore some of the complex issues it unearths, this character study about privacy and perception shows a lot of truth in its fantastical premise. Dream Scenario kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the Doctor Who specials with Doctor Who the Star Beast and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring MST3K Season 13. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the reviews with Doctor Who, the Star Beast. The Doctor returns in his 10th incarnation and collides with Donna Noble to face an alien threat.
Now, about this friend called Donna Noble. I had to wipe her memory to save her life. So what happens now? The spaceship crashes right in front of her. It's like she's drawing us in. I don't believe in destiny, but if destiny exists, then it is is heading for Donna Noble. And I've got a memory. After a very long time, something's coming back.
Who are they?
Monsters.
It's the 60th anniversary of Doctor Who. I remember the 50th anniversary. I'm getting so old. It's terrifying. If you're not a fan of Doctor Who, you're going to be lost on this. I'm a huge fan of Doctor Who. I remember watching Doctor Who when I was a kid in the 70s. I was watching Tom Baker's The Fourth Doctor, you know, shot on videotape with terrible special effects. And the series ended in, I think, 1989 or something like that. It was the end of the 80s. They did a TV movie in the 90s. And then it disappeared until 2005, where they resurrected it and rebooted it with Christopher Eccleston. And they decided to continue the Doctor. They didn't just restart the story. They continued with the characters that already existed. And David Tennant followed up Christopher Eccleston, and he was a very popular actor as the Doctor. Between him and Matt Smith, most people will recognize the two of them as sort of the modern Doctors that everybody loved. I mean, Peter Capaldi was good, and he has his fans, and Jodie Whittaker was good, but those two, Matt Smith and David Tennant, are the most popular ones right now. Now, the thing is, with Doctor Who, is he regenerates. Whenever his body gets too old, as a Time Lord, he's an alien, his body turns into another body. And it's a great way. It was basically a device that they used to recast the character when the first Doctor back in the 60s got too old and had to leave the show. And so he regenerated from Jodie Whittaker into the 10th version of the Doctor again as David Tennant. So what they're doing is they have specials. They have these 1-hour specials. It's not really a season, but there was one last week, which I'm talking about now, and there's going to be one this week on Saturday, and then the next week there's going to be another one on Saturday or Sunday, and they drop on Disney Plus. If you've got Disney Plus, and this is the first time Disney Plus has had it. It used to be just a BBC thing, and then BBC America, they were rebranding it for American audiences, and Warner Brothers had the exclusive streaming capabilities. And if you want to go and watch the reboots of Doctor Who from like 2005, Christopher Eccleston through Jodie Whittaker, you can find them on Max. If you want to watch the classic Doctor Who, you're going to have to get BritBox, and I don't know if that's a standalone or if I get it through Amazon. But this is now on Disney Plus. So if you're a Doctor Who fan, you got to get at least 3 or 4 services to watch all of it. The character of Donna Noble is played by Catherine Tate, who she's known as a comedian in Britain, and she's done comedy over here. But she was on The Office for a little bit. She's this redheaded comedian. And she played one of his companions that he had to basically block her memory so she didn't die. And there's a whole explanation for it. And they bring her back in this episode. So it's a 1-hour kind of one-off episode. And then she's going to travel with him for 2 more weeks. And then we get the new Doctor who's going to be showing up for the Christmas special, which I'm looking forward to. But this one is... It's a throwback to the Doctor Who episodes during David Tennant's years. It plays off of a lot of the characters, and you see people showing up again that he had run into in the Donna Noble years, which I believe she was in the 3rd season of Doctor Who. She was in the 3rd season with David Tennant. And I didn't like her character at first because she's a sassy, somewhat pushy character. And after watching some of Catherine Tate's comedy in Britain and looking at all the different characters, she has a series on Netflix called Hard Sell, where she runs a woman's prison and plays all these different characters in it. And I find her very funny. So I've grown to appreciate the character of Donna Noble, played by Catherine Tate. And so it's nice to see her back. I mean, this is all a very nostalgic thing. And Doctor Who has been known since they rebooted the series to have Christmas specials. And they always do special things, not every year, but every year that they're producing episodes, they either do a Christmas special or a couple specials leading up to it. And that's what we've got here. And the story, it's a basic story. It's a very typical Doctor Who story. Alien coming down and threatening the whole of Earth, and the Doctor has to figure out how to stop this alien threat with his companion. But really, like I said, this is made for the fans. This is pandering a bit, and that's okay. I mean, it's a nostalgic return to David Tennant's tenure with a routine story punctuated with some tender moments. I mean, there's some really good moments here. There's some great character moments that'll be lost on people if you've not watched the David Tennant years. of the series. But still, I enjoyed it. Pretty much, I'm an easy mark when it comes to Doctor Who. So I'm going to have to say this totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Mystery Science Theater 3000 Season 13. I'm going to play the trailer and then I'll talk a little bit about it, why this is important. The Mads and the Bots are back for another season, which includes a new human co-host to watch terrible movies and make fun of them.
Hold on to your box.
Oh, we got movie stars!
Mystery Science Theater 3000 is coming back again.
Movie in the hole.
13 brand new episodes, including some of the cheesiest movies ever.
Vin Diesel in The Slow and the Steady.
And there is where we'll put the sick flat screen.
Oh, it's like a Hershey kiss in a suit.
Bright and shining beacon to the worst that cinema has to offer.
Well, at this point, I'm all out of dignity, so let's go.
Success!
I've watched Mystery Science Theater ever since its second or season, I think. It was something I watched when I was in college. It started in the late 80s and rolled into the 90s, and I watched it throughout the 90s. Big fan. I literally made my parents get cable when I was in college so we could watch it over the summer. The premise being this guy's in space and he has these robots and they go watch bad movies in the theater and make fun of them. It's very, very funny, very irreverent. It's a classic cult TV show. And Netflix rebooted that because they were originally on the Comedy Channel and then Comedy Central, and then it moved to the Sci-Fi Channel when Michael J. Nelson was in charge of it after Joel Hodgins left. And then Netflix rebooted it with a Kickstarter campaign, and they had two seasons. They had like an 11th season and then a 12th short season called The Gauntlet, which had like six episodes to it. And they have a new cast, and what's nice is they've brought in this new cast going back to the Netflix years, and they got new people doing the voices of the bots. So they got a whole new slate of people doing it, but they've preserved a lot of the quality of the jokes and the type of jokes you have. I mean, it's a little bit different. It's a higher budget and it's a slicker looking production. There was something warm and fuzzy about the old MST3Ks, like the first couple seasons where it was literally shot in some local studio in Minnesota. But this is a little higher class and they have like digital effects and stuff, but it's still back to them just making fun of the movies. And in this season, they bring in a second host because they got Jonah Ray playing Jonah Heston. They have this new host, Emily Connors, her name, the character's name, and they just kind of have a separate theater. So it's shared. And I think it's partly a not have it all be filled with dudes, which makes sense. Like they got a woman doing the voice of Crow. And that's okay. I think it's funny. I enjoy it. I think Emily's hilarious and she's kind of cute too. So, you know, it's nice to watch those. But I'll tell you what had happened was when they did the 13th season, they didn't go to Netflix. They created essentially their own app, which is called the Gizmoplex. And if you wanted to watch those Mystery Science Theater's episodes, you had to subscribe. It's its own streaming service, essentially. So you had to subscribe to that. And so I was just wondering if I was ever going to get to see these season 13 episodes. And during Turkey Day, which every year at Thanksgiving, they do a Turkey Day marathon, which is a bunch of turkey movies that they show. And I found out that they have dropped these season 13 episodes on a bunch of these free streaming services. I'm watching them on Freevee, which is a part of the Amazon app. So they don't cost anything, and you got commercials in them. But then again, going back to the original MST3K episode, you had commercials because it was on Comedy Central. And it's the first time I've actually known that you could watch these. And I put them all in my queue, and I started watching them because I'd never seen these new episodes, and I love MST3K. So these new episodes are fun. They're a little bit different, and the show's evolved a bit in the sense that you've got new voices and new people making the jokes. You just don't have the same 5 to 8 people sitting there in a Minnesota writing room. So you've got a bigger writing room, but like I said, they still retain the essence and the charm. And they're doing movies. Some of them are more recent ones, but they're doing movies from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and even the 60s and the 50s. They're fun, and I enjoy it. It's back, and they're making fundraisers for next season. So yeah, this is the classic movie riffing show that has evolved, but keeps the clever zingers coming. I'm going to have to say Mystery Science Theater 3000 Season 13 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that's it. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Poor Things, The Boy and the Heron, and Mr. Monk's Last Case. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.